it's really clear to us that pillaging is really being edged more and more into center stage.
You're listening to the USSC Briefing Room, a podcast from the United States Study Center at the University of Sydney, where we give you a seat at the table for a USSC briefing on the latest developments in US news and foreign policy. We'll cover what you need to know and what's beneath the surface of the news. Hello, I'm Mari Kirk, Director of Engagement and Impact at the USSC. Thanks for joining us on the USSC Briefing Room today. And before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we're recording on today. The University of Sydney is located on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and future. And when a delegation from USSC went to DC last year, Australia was anticipating a visit from President Biden for the Quad, and on AUKUS it was all about ITAR reform. There was no discussion of tensions in the Middle East, and it seemed there was a decent chance that Ron DeSantis could get the Republican nomination to run for president. Now we're just hoping for a visit from President Biden. We're talking about expanding AUKUS. There's a war in Gaza making daily headlines. And former President Trump is leading in the polls for the upcoming election. So last month, researchers from USSC's Foreign Policy and Defense team traveled back to the U.S. And what has changed over the past year? Does the view on the ground match what we're seeing in the headlines? And how much daylight is there between the U.S. and Australian foreign policy communities at the moment? To discuss these questions, I'm joined by research fellow Tom Corbin and research associate Sophie Mayo to give us their take following their recent trip to the U.S. Okay, so I might just kick off with you, Sophie, first. I'd love to get a bit of a readout from your trip. Can you tell me about what your main objective was and what you did while you were in D.C.?
Yeah, absolutely, Mari. So Tom and I recently got back from our D.C. adventure with Mike Green, of course, USSC's CEO, and our colleague, Chris Watterson. We were there for about a week at the end of March, which just so happened to be prime cherry blossom season, for a series of consultations and engagements related to a major project we're delivering on US-Australia defense industrial base integration. So the context is that at the start of this year, the US government released their National Defense Industrial Strategy, or NDIS, as it's called. And this is a first-of-kind document, which was quickly followed by the release of Australia's own defense industry development strategy. So off the back of the release of the US NDIS, our team, led by Tom, is delivering a major report assessing what the strategy portends for Australian equities and bilateral defense industrial integration initiatives. We're also delivering three smaller policy briefs as part of the same project, which offer a deep dive into niche aspects of this larger problem set. So the trip was really about engaging with a wide variety of stakeholders across government, industry, think tanks, and actually the education sector to interrogate the strategy's core themes and what they mean for Australia. And these include things like the tension between Buy American and allies and partners, and economic deterrence for defense supply chains, as well as to conduct consultation for one of the smaller policy briefs, which I'm writing about how the US and Australia can cooperate to broaden and deepen the national security innovation bases. And this starts from the premise that the commercial technology sector is leading progress in 11 out of 14 of the US DoD's critical tech areas, and yet these entities are disincentivized to work with the US and Australian governments for a variety of reasons.
So Sophie, were you just there for a week? It sounded like you crammed an awful lot in, but was it just 7 days that you were there?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually it might've been less than that. We arrived late night on Sunday and left on the following Saturday. So it was manic, but very, very interesting.
Yeah, well, it sounds very exciting, but you must've just had to squeeze a whole lot in. And I remember the delegation last year, it was just on the go, but it was so fruitful. Every discussion we had was so impactful and great. And Tom, you were there last year when we went again this year. And we've had two delegation visits to the US this past year. So what would you say has changed most in terms of defense and defense industrial policy from 2023 to 2024? And I'm thinking especially of AUKUS, because that was a major part of every discussion we had last year.
Yeah, thanks, Mara. I think for me, from this trip last month, probably three key differences stand out with respect to the trip we conducted last year. The first would be that I think the view that defense industrial cooperation is the binding tissue or the glue for the rest of the alliance initiative with respect to defense, that's kind of become the consensus view or the consensus framing mechanism for most U.S. stakeholders across the U.S. system. My impression is that's more well understood now across the U.S. and the Australian system, in fact, than it was in 2023, that view being that getting defense industrial collaboration right is essential to maximizing the benefits of basically everything else that we currently do and, in fact, have historically done in the defense space in the alliance over the last 10 or 20 years. AUKUS Pillar 1 basically encapsulates that framing and that approach that I think policymakers in Australia and the U.S. want to apply to other initiatives going forward. So that spans things like the acquisition of defense capabilities. So obviously in the case of AUKUS Pillar 1, we're talking about nuclear-powered submarines. It also relates to force posture and maximizing those arrangements, particularly those that are in Australia themselves. So obviously the first stage of AUKUS Pillar 1 involves the rotation of US and UK submarines through Australian facilities on the West Coast. There's also a significant workforce component to this, so improving the interchangeability or interoperability, if you will, between the workforces of all three AUKUS countries. But specifically for Australia, making sure that we have the skill sets in this country to maintain, operate, sustain and overhaul nuclear-powered submarines as and when they start to come online, both for our own forces, but also for those rotating through our facilities from other countries. That goes to a wider question of industrial capacity. Does Australia have the capacity in the right areas to maximize our benefit to an alliance initiative around industrial and technological issues? And then finally, there's the kind of the broader regulatory and policy environment, which I know we'll get to later in the discussion, but you know, things like export controls, information sharing, vetting processes, security clearance, all of those things. All of these separate strands really fall under the same overarching concept of defense industrial integration, and they're all essential to enabling us to do the sorts of operations and activities in the defense space that the alliance seeks to do. The second main takeaway from the trip, I think, was the focus on implementation. I think when we were there in 2023, there was a lot of discussion around things that might need to happen in order to grease the wheels of AUKUS Pillar 1 and AUKUS Pillar 2, but particularly Pillar 1. I think now, given the authorities that you saw in the 2024 National Defense Authorization Act, just for people who aren't aware, that's basically the annual defense bill that is passed through Congress to authorize the administration to spend money or to make changes to U.S. legal code in specific areas. There are a whole bunch of changes with relevance to AUKUS included in that particular NDAA, particularly around workforce, authorizing Australia to input financially into the U.S. industrial base, the exchange of sailors between the U.S. and the Australian navies, but also some pretty significant reforms to things like defense export controls to make it easier for the two countries to conduct defense trade, but also exchange technology and work on said technology together. Probably the third thing that I would note is that there's much more attention turning to the mechanics and the ecosystem surrounding Pillar 2. A lot of work has been done to get Pillar 1 moving, and it seemed fairly clear to us over the course of the trip that U.S. stakeholders are pretty upbeat about where this is going. You know, even if there's been some conjecture around the budget allocations in the FY25 budget proposal to submarine acquisition and what that might mean for AUKUS, I think if you look in the details of the budget, there's actually a lot of money going into making sure that the defense industrial base can deliver for Australian and US requirements in the submarine space over the next 10 to 20 years. This is bigger than a single budget line item in any given year. I don't want to steal Sophie's thunder too much here because I know we're going to get into a discussion around Pillar 2 in particular, but I think the scope, the scale, and the overall purpose of Pillar 2 is much more in the spotlight than it was perhaps a year ago. And I think stakeholders in both the Australian and the US systems are really starting to grapple with some of the more difficult questions, kind of beyond the export control piece. That's a single piece of what needs to be revisited if Pillar 2 is going to function properly.
As we mentioned last year, we were talking so much about AUKUS, but it was a lot around AUKUS Pillar 1 in the meetings last year. Was there any buzz around AUKUS Pillar 2 while you were in DC? And especially any talk around JAUKUS, which has been making waves here around the announcement that, you know, it's not a formal invitation yet, but there's an openness in considering whether Japan would be added into Pillar 2 of the AUKUS agreement. So was that coming up in any of your discussions when you're in DC? Sophie, I might start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll jump in on the buzz about Pillar 2, and Tom is our resident Japan expert, so I'll let him handle the JAUKUS question. There was buzz about Pillar 2. A lot of it was positive. It's really clear to us that Pillar 2 is really being edged more and more into center stage. And I think, again, as Tom said, that that's reflected in the sorts of opportunities and challenges people are starting to discuss. It's no longer an unknown entity. A lot of meat's been put onto its bones since this time last year, including things like the announcement of the first AUKUS Innovation Challenge on electronic warfare and of the AUKUS Industry Group and the AUKUS Defense Investors Group. And critically, as Tom mentioned, the 2024 National Defense Authorization Act passed relatively recently, which contained the provisions to establish a national exemption for Australia and the UK from US defense export control licensing pending certification from President Biden that both countries have comparable defense export control systems. So partly as a result of these developments, there are discussions happening in DC about things like whether or not we'll see a marquee project before the next US, UK, and potentially Australian elections. There's also conjecture about when exactly Australia and the UK are likely to receive a comparable certification from President Biden. People were also talking about exceptions to the Pillar 2 exemptions in relation to ITAR. And one likely case is hypersonics, which for those who don't know, is a Pillar 2 advanced capability technology. So I think that the Australian strategic community and industry should be watching this one very closely to see how it plays out and what impacts it might have on prospects for co-innovation and co-production. In short, if some categories of Pillar 2 advanced capabilities are branded with exemptions to the ITAR exception, it will mean that trilateral cooperation on these technologies will remain relatively cumbersome. More positively, I think it's safe to say that there's a lot of excitement. The key steps have been taken to set the enabling environment for Pillar 2. So we've touched on export controls, but there are additional issues and conversations going on related to things like foreign disclosure, procurement policies, information sharing and certification systems and the like. And it was clear to us that US interlocutors are also starting to think ambitiously about things like how to get acquisition and sustainment folk integrated in a more serious way so that the three AUKUS countries can start to align things like procurement and to find workarounds for tricky budgeting, especially in the case of the US. So all of this planning and discussion will eventually, hopefully, lead to co-innovation and co-development in the most ambitious sense. Pleasingly, there is also a lot of thinking happening about how to help dual-use firms producing what may become Pillar 2 advanced capabilities navigate the Valley of Death, unfortunately, which is basically the long process between securing developing a technology and testing it and securing a contract with the government, which many companies don't make it through. Unfortunately, in the case of AUKUS, there are only three countries, so that's three markets, whereas in a similar but not exactly the same formation like NATO and their Defense Innovation Accelerator, which is called DIANA, you have 32 countries, so naturally that's a much larger market there, and dual-use firms playing in the defense space can very easily skip past the Valley of Death. Regardless, it's positive that these conversations are live in the AUKUS context.
That's very interesting to hear and a great comparison as well in terms of the ramifications And Pillar 2 has been such a huge part of the news. Tom, what did Japan come up in your discussions? Because you were there shortly before this announcement around Japan came out. But was it being talked about in DC at that time?
Sure. Just to maybe add a final point onto Sophie's excellent overview before I address the Japan bit. I think there's a broader recalibration going on, at least across the Australian government. And I think it's starting to catch on in the US government about reframing what it is exactly that Pillar 2 is supposed to achieve and what constitutes what you might consider a legitimate AUKUS Pillar 2 output. So I think when it was first announced and kind of in the subsequent 12 to 18 months after that, and even up until the present day, I think there's been this misunderstanding amongst the commentary and the policy community that in the absence of a trilaterally developed from scratch shiny missile or drone or, you know, product of a Pillar 2 advanced capability category that has an AUKUS bumper sticker on it, that AUKUS Pillar 2 is not functioning as it should. Whereas in reality, I think that's, you know, that's the ideal end state that the three countries want to get to, but partially as a process of figuring out how to make AUKUS Pillar 2 work properly, but also because of very well understood barriers and impediments to such collaboration that predated AUKUS by some decades. I think the policymakers in Australia and the US at least are starting to reframe things like export control reform or wider regulatory harmonization across the three countries as a legitimate AUKUS Pillar 2 output. And I think that is a valid argument to make. And to go to Sophie's point, you have to set the ecosystem to allow for streamlined collaboration before you go and do these projects, because otherwise you're going to be looking for carve-outs for every single discrete project that you have, and that's not sustainable from a bureaucratic or time perspective. You might also consider things like you know, improving the operational efficiency of advanced capabilities that all three countries already operate as a legitimate Pillar 2 output. So some of the innovation activities that we've seen have involved, you know, data sharing, comparing controller design, generating common AI algorithms to process acoustic data from the underwater domain, for example. Like, these aren't necessarily new things, but making sure that all three countries can maximize the efficacy of the things that they have, but also making sure that in the event that there's a conflict, that a British operator, for example, can pick up the controller for an Australian drone and operate it just as effectively. Those are equally important outputs for Pillar 2. On the Japan point, we heard some fairly cryptic remarks from US stakeholders. I think it was a week or two or three before the recent leaders summit in DC. And before that, the line in the AUKUS Defense Minister's joint statement about considering Japan for future collaboration on specific AUKUS Pillar 2 projects. I think that line in that statement, and it's important to note that it was a single line in an otherwise very lengthy statement about AUKUS Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, kind of got overblown in the Australian context. I've seen a lot of headlines about Japan formally joining AUKUS or Japan's about to be integrated into AUKUS Pillar 2, and that's simply inaccurate. What the three countries have done has put on record as a trilateral their shared view that Japan is among the leading nations to consider for collaboration in the Pillar 2 space on specific projects. There is no mechanism to formally integrate Japan into AUKUS at this point, and I'm pretty sure that senior figures in all three countries have actually come out and said that that's not a possibility in the near future and may not actually be desirable in the long term, given that the trust and community that AUKUS is meant to represent, you know, it can't get too big. Otherwise, it's going to become unwieldy, particularly at a point where we actually haven't figured out how to do the sorts of things we would like to do in space. That said, it's not a bad idea to bring Japan into the conversation at this point. You could make the argument that there is actually no point in engaging Japan or any other fourth party until the three countries who are core AUKUS members actually figure out how to do what they want to do. On the other hand, the fact that all three countries have said individually and together that they want to bring other countries into the conversation means that it's probably to Japan's advantage to be a part of that conversation at an earlier stage. So really the choice here would be for Japan to wait for Australia, the UK and the US to figure out the rules of the road for cooperating with fourth parties like Japan. Or if Japan is brought into the conversation when those discussions are still ongoing, it can actually play a role in shaping the rules that it will have to abide by if it's going to participate in Pillar 2. And if you ask policymakers in Tokyo, I think they would much prefer the latter rather than the former.
So if the foreign policy community in DC, if maybe they gave some cryptic comments around the possibility of inviting Japan to join AUKUS in the future, what would you say were the big focus areas that you talked about with them? And how well were they aligned to Australian interests?
Well, Murray, broadly, I think that it's good news for Australia. The stakeholders that we spoke to are thinking about issues that are actually really high on Australia's priority list. Firstly, it's clear that the US is conceiving of their industrial base as deterrence, but more specifically, their defense industrial base as deterrence, but more specifically of an integrated defense industrial base as deterrence. And they really want to accelerate that and to unwind what is ostensibly a Cold War defense industrial base system within a 2.5 year timeline so that defense industrial initiatives like AUKUS and like the Guided Weapons and Explosive Ordnance Enterprise, or GWEO, can really work. So that was really positive to hear. Related to this, I think that it was clear that there's a lot of thought going into how to do defense industrial participation or partnership between Australia and other allied and partner firms and US firms and communities in a way that's palatable to the US domestic audience. There's probably some mapping that needs to be done on the Australian end to illustrate the value Australian inputs are delivering to the US defense industrial base and to the firms and communities that make up this collective. But I'll acknowledge that this won't be an easy task. The US remains reticent to share sensitive information regarding specific bottlenecks or vulnerabilities. And even if these can be worked out through consultations and open source analysis, it's still hard for Australia to quantify its value add into the US system unless it knows what's missing from the larger picture on the US end. Secondly, with the date for President Biden's determination on whether Australia and the UK have comparable export control regimes rapidly approaching, the US policy community, it was clear to us, is thinking about what effect a failed certification on the first try might have on public perceptions of AUKUS, and also how to ensure the language in the exemption is actually useful to industry. In addition to that, how to tackle the next barriers to defense industrial integration, such as the Missile Technology Control Regime, or to give you yet another acronym, the MTECR. So on the first point, a potentially delayed certification, this is kind of expected, and there will be further opportunities prior to September for President Biden to determine that Australia and the UK are compliant. However, as I mentioned, there is a concern around the message that this sends to the public mostly. I think for industry, there's a greater understanding of the importance of getting this right, of getting the language right, because once the regulations are in place, they'll be very, very difficult to wind back. And on MTCR, there is live discussion going on about AUKUS Pillar 2 technology that might actually be captured by this regime, which would then have to be licensed, and a lot of documents and paperwork would come with that, which would slow down cooperation on Pillar 2 and potentially other defense industrial initiatives. But I think broadly it's a positive sign for Australia that a wide variety of stakeholders that we spoke to in the US are really aware of this issue and are giving it a lot of thought.
Yeah, that's very encouraging to hear. I guess my last question before I get the by-the-number stat from each of you is if you have any other highlights or surprises from the trip that you think we should know.
Yeah, Maureen, look, something that surprised me was that people are actually really starting to consider what Australia's sovereign defence industry might look like in a post-ITAR world. And what I mean by that is that if there is a defence-free trade bubble of sorts that's established between the three countries, is there still a need for legally separate prime contractors. So Australia's sovereign defence industry, especially at the prime contractor level, is really just a group of mostly US and UK prime contractors with Australia on the end of their name. So think Northrop Grumman Australia, Raytheon Australia, BAE Systems Australia, and the like. Granted, these are legally separate entities from their US or UK domiciled bases. So the question that came up is there still a need for a legally separate Northrop Grumman Australia, to use an example, to the American Northrop Grumman? Do these companies still need to have separate boards of directors and so forth? So I'm really interested to see how this plays out and to see what shape Australia's new defence trade controls legislation and the ITAR exemption might leave our sovereign defence industry in.
I find that really, you know, interesting and indicative of the trip as a whole. Like, a lot of these things in terms of the progress that's been made over the past year, it's not easy, but it seems to be, you know, being done well. And there's a lot of progress that's happened. So it's very encouraging to reflect back and see all of that. Now, I'd love to get your by the numbers stats related to this topic. I might start with you, Sophie. What have you got for us today?
Well, Mari, I'm going to take a bit of a creative approach to the by-the-numbers directive. Rest assured, it does include a quantitative term. So one of the key themes that came out of the NDIS that we've talked about today was this notion of Buy American versus allies and partners, or friendshoring versus reshoring. And one interesting stat I came across is that by the mid-2020s, all the components of U.S. ships are to be made in the U.S., now, whether you think that Buy American and allies and partners are competing things or not, it is difficult to look past this concrete date and goal and not spare a thought for the trajectory of allied defense industrial base integration. Now, there are mechanisms to get around this, like reciprocal defense procurement agreements, which basically promote the standardization, interoperability, and interchangeability of defense equipment with allies. But regardless, that data point did strike as potentially traveling in the opposite direction to allied defense industrial base integration, or at the least, if that is perhaps an overstatement, it says something about the domestic audiences and tensions that the U.S. has to manage.
Yeah, that's very complex. Did you say mid-2020s, so in about a year or
so? Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah.
That's very striking. Wow, fascinating. Thanks, Sophie. How about you, Tom? What do you have?
I actually have three different numbers, but they're all interrelated. So the first number is 80. The second number is 55, and the third number is 145%. So the first number is the approximate number of Tomahawk land attack missiles that were fired by the U.S. Navy at Houthi rebel positions in Yemen in 1 or 2 days at the beginning of the Red Sea commercial shipping protection operations that we've seen going on for a few months. The second number, 55, is the number of Tomahawks that were procured by the U.S. Navy the previous year. And the third number is the percentage of the expenditure rate of those days of operations compared to the procurement from the previous. So in other words, in the opening days of the Red Sea operations, the U.S. Navy used 145% of the missiles that it had procured from the previous. A fourth figure that might be of interest here is zero, which is the number of Tomahawks that were procured in the FY24 defense budget. So these figures, they're important in a couple of contexts with relevance to Australia. So the first would be U.S. prioritization resourcing demands. In the Middle East, we're seeing a high usage rate for the strike and air defense missiles that we will probably see high consumption rates of in a contingency in the Indo-Pacific. The Secretary of the Navy, Carlos Del Toro, has already said that the U.S. has consumed more than $1 billion worth of munitions for those operations alone. And an extension of those operations for platforms carrying those weapons, such as ships and aircraft, is also driving up unforeseen and unbudgeted operations and maintenance costs. So overall, you're seeing these unexpected budgetary pressures on accounts that were already under pressure before the Red Sea operations began. This is kind of different to when you look at Ukraine with respect to a discussion around prioritization, where we're seeing high usage rates of things like 155mm artillery shells and rockets for platforms like HIMARS. But those aren't really going to be directly relevant to a contingency in the Indo-Pacific in the way that things like Tomahawks and air defense. It's also important in the context of right-sizing Australia-US defence industrial collaboration, because as I'm sure many of our listeners know, Australia is attempting to stand up its own guided weapons and explosive ordnance enterprise. The initial pilot projects for GWEO are for 155mm and guided rockets for platforms like HIMARS. Theoretically, it depends who you ask. Theoretically, those pilot projects will largely meet ADF requirements and to some extent input into global supply chains or global market demands. But there are still some critical details that need fleshing out here with respect to Australia's guided weapons and explosive ordnance enterprise. So for example, there hasn't really been much of a discussion yet about which third parties will be enabled to buy these weapons if they're not going to the Australian or the US militaries. Will U.S. services like the U.S. Army actually buy these in sufficient quantities rather than to go to the Buy America conversation, procuring them from somewhere like Arkansas where they can get them cheaper even if the timeline is a little bit longer? It's also an important discussion to have in the context of Australia's new national defense strategy, which has underscored the reorientation of the Australian Defense Force towards a force that is more focused on deterrence in the air and sea domains in the Indo-Pacific, rather than a force that is flexible and capable of being deployed to far-flung theaters like the Middle East. So in that sense, where these numbers link up with what I've just sketched out is that ideally, Australian industry and government stakeholders would like to see GWEO get to the point where Australia is capable of manufacturing much of the componentry that goes into the kinds of munitions that are likely to be used in high quantities in the Indo-Pacific. We're not there yet. Obviously, the initial pilot projects are focused on the land domain, and this isn't to say that the land domain doesn't have an important place in thinking through contingencies in the Indo-Pacific. But it's widely accepted that Australia's requirements really do fall squarely into the air and the maritime strike buckets. So where does this all kind of wrap up to? In an ideal future, Australia will be capable of either producing complete missiles or producing, you know, 90% of the missiles and then procuring the rest of the 10% of the componentry for more classified or sensitive technologies from the United States, and being directly able to input those missiles into not only Australia's own force structure requirements, but also backfilling unexpected or expected US shortfalls in their stockpiles or in their production capacity. And to link this back to the opening statement I made around the three figures that I've selected for this week, you know, the fact that the United States is now engaged in a prolonged military operation in the Middle East, once again, that is using assets and munitions that are of high relevance to Australian equities in the Indo-Pacific and an imaginable future contingency, it really just underscores the need to actually really get this right-sized and get it moving quickly. I think that neatly ties into the overall topics that we've been discussing today around defense industrial integration and some of the barriers that still stand up.
Yeah. Oh, those are very sobering numbers from both of you. Thank you so much, but very relevant. And it reminds me to, you know, give a plug for the work of the Foreign Policy Defense Team, in particular, as they have launched this GWEO initiative. So working on these sorts of defense capabilities for Australia. But working with the, you know, defense primes, working with government to find a chart of course to solve some of these really tricky challenges as we kind of bridge the gap from where we are now to where Australia needs to be. So yeah, very fantastic and great to chat with you both today. As we wrap up, I'd just like to point out a couple of other podcasts that may be of interest to our audience. Our CEO, Dr. Michael Green, is the co-host of the Asia Chessboard podcast with Jude Blanchett, the Freeman Chair for China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'd also recommend checking out the USSC Live podcast series that runs recordings from our major live events, including our 2024 Election Watch kickoff. You can find these on our website at ussc.edu.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Tom and Sophie, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Thanks so much, Mari.
Thanks, Mari.